everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, my wife Lisa and I got to participate in a family camp in Northwest Arkansas. And it wasn't like any other family camp I've ever been a part of. There were people of all ages there. There were about 250 people, and 8 of them were white. And 6 were African American, and about 235 were Lao. Lao, they had a heritage from Laos. And we have a precious relationship with one of the people that runs the camp, and they'd asked us to come and help out, and we were thrilled to do it. And so there we were at this family camp, and Lisa and I were placed into a small group of the people our age, which for those who are wondering is, I don't know, somewhere between 25 and 50-something. I'm not even going to get into that. But it was the adults, the parents, really, of some of the teenagers and young adults and children. And Lisa and I spent most of the weekend asking each of the people in our small group, and then actually any Lao adult we could find, to tell us their story. How did you come to America? And they all had the same story. Like, it was beat by beat the same. They would say, well, when I was 4 or 5 or 8, somewhere in that range, in the early 1980s, the communists had taken over Laos, and it was no longer safe for my parents to live here. We were going to be killed as a family, and so we had to get out. And every adult we talked to, this is modern day, remembers what it was like escaping Laos. They said our parents saved money to pay a man who could paddle us in a canoe across the river where we could get to the refugee camps. And a couple of the guys said to me, they said, one of my predominant memories is my dad telling me to lay as flat as I could in the bottom of the canoe so the bullets would have less chance of hitting us as we went over. Terrifying. And so these families were trying to escape Laos to safety, and they'd ended up in Thailand in refugee camps. And then they would make their way. The goal was to try to get to America, which had a very open refugee policy. And so they would go to Thailand and then the Philippines, refugee camp by refugee camp, for 2 years. And then they ended up in Dallas and Oklahoma City and Northwest Arkansas, and they assimilated into American culture. And I don't know, some of the Lao people I talked to, they said they're not sure the percentage, because almost everyone from Laos is Buddhist, but somewhere around 10%, maybe more, became Christian. And I asked them, did you go to a church, like they're in Oklahoma City or Dallas, and they all went to Baptist churches. And I was like, well, you can't get everything right, I guess. That's okay, you did your best. But I said to them, like, were you going to a Baptist church because that was the way to belong in America, in that part of the country? They said, no, no, I was on a spiritual quest. What had happened to me? And I just got to thinking, because I'm an immigrant, and I've made this mistake before. Those of you who don't know me, I host a podcast, and I have all number of guests on my podcast. And once I had a Vietnamese theologian who's also an artist named Phu Lu. Dr. Lu is a New Testament scholar. He's a fine artist. He's a remarkable human being. And as he's on my podcast, I said to him, oh, I'm an immigrant. And he says, I'm not an immigrant. I'm a refugee. He corrected me. I appreciated that correction, because his experience and my experience of coming to this country, worlds apart. But as an immigrant, when I meet another Australian, we talk about home. We go right to it. Where are you from? When have you been home? We ask each other. When's the last time you got home? And I asked these Lao adults, every one of them, I said, oh, when's the last time you went home? And they gave me a weird look. Home? Like Friday. I was just home. What are you talking about? I said, no, no, I'm sorry. When is the last time you went back to Laos? And they said, never. I'm never going back to Laos. Why would I go back there? And it helped me realize, as refugees, their identity is not in their place, it's in their experience. And that's how, when they came to America in Dallas and Oklahoma and all the places they went, they would find each other and form the community. And those who became Christians, those who did not stay Buddhist, became what's now known nationally 40 years later as the Lao Baptist Network. They're everywhere. I'd never heard of them before. They're all over the place. And we got to go to the Lao Baptist Network National Family Camp. It was an incredible privilege for us. Learned a lot. It was really moving. We had a blast. But it just got me to thinking. Like, imagine that you're not sitting in church September 2024. Imagine you're sitting in some Baptist church in, I don't know, Oklahoma City, 1983. Like, if you can just use your imagination, you're not here today, but it's the same idea. There's some dude preaching, probably too long. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But you're sitting there, and you manage to endure the sermon. Congratulations. And then someone gets up to give announcements, and you're like, okay, I didn't think we were going to do this. How long are the announcements? This is what we always ask, right, during announcements. Is that okay to say out loud? That's often what we ask. And you're sitting there, you've endured the sermon, and now there's the announcement person, and they're talking about the men's retreat, and you're like, fine. And they're talking about how they need more people to volunteer in the kids' ministry, and you're like, fine. You're already committing the buffet in your heart. Like, when can we get to lunch? And then they just say very offhand, hey, Refugee Relocation has called our church and asked us if maybe we could help. There's some refugees have just moved into town, and we would just like to do a little donation, and maybe some of you would be willing to help. And you think to yourself, oh, I'll give to that. Like, the plate passes, and you think, oh, I'd totally give. I would love to help a refugee family get established in this country. That would be a great thing to do. And then the next Sunday, your Sunday school is talking about it. Sunday school, because small groups weren't even invented back then. You're in Baptist Sunday school. Yes, picture the flannel graph. Picture it all. Picture the parachute pants. It's 1980s. Picture the pastel colors. Picture it all. But there you are in your Sunday school. And your Sunday school says, hey, yeah, we're going to give money, but actually what we'd like to do is go and buy the plateware and the cups and the tablecloth. Let's set up their kitchen for them. And so you're like, right, I'm in on that. And it's 1983, and you go, and not only have you given money to your church to help, but you've also gone, and now you're in their house. And here is this family, and they're quite demure. They don't speak very good English, and they're quite shy. And there's three little kids, and one of them is hiding behind his mom's leg. You've ever seen that happen before? Where you go into a house, and the kid doesn't know you, and you're a big, scary adult, and this kid has his mom by the leg. All I'm doing is telling you that's 1983, and now we're in 2024. Here's my point. I met that kid. I was in his small group. His name's Cholo. He lives 10 minutes from here. I had dinner at his house 6 weeks ago. He's an IT professional and a part-time volunteer pastor for the Loud Baptist Church of Thornton. Right now they meet in his house. I may have overstepped, and I said, hey, the day you need a congregation, call Discovery. We'd love to host you. That's what we do. When you give money to your church on any given Sunday, you really have no idea the impact. That's my point. I feel like Lisa and I got to see the other side of it. You know, normally we don't even pass the plate anymore. We've got boxes and so much of it is online now, right? But back when we used to pass the plate and you'd put that money in the offering plate, doesn't it often feel to you as it often feels to me that it just kind of goes into the abyss? I'm not saying it's not well used. It's just you don't get to see what's God doing with this financial gift I'm making. And I just felt like, man, we got to see it. I also will pay better attention to announcements. God, kingdom generosity, it multiplies impact in time and space. That's what it does. You give something, you give your time, you give your money, and then God uses that and multiplies it over time and spreads it wide. It's unbelievable. And you might think to yourself, okay, that's one story. That's one group of refugees from one country that had one need. But when you just stop and look at the needs in the world, it's so overwhelming. I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like I cannot keep up with all the broken places in this world. There's too many of them. And it's very tempting to go numb and just check out and say, forget it, I can't do anything. Or I think the other temptation is I'm going to move into a permanent state of outrage, which is what is Twitter. That's what Twitter was born. That's why it exists, is so we can get on there and be outraged about all the broken places. There must be a middle ground. Like, how do you choose what need to help and what need to trust that someone else will help? When you just look at it from an issues and statistics point of view, it's defeating. I'll just say it. It's defeating. Too many issues. The statistics are rough and they're all going in the wrong direction. And then what some people say is, well, if you can just help a few, at least you help those few. It makes all the difference. Those of you who are church veterans, you might remember, it's a classic preaching story, the starfish analogy. I'm just going to, for those in the room, I know we're also online. If you're familiar with the story of the starfish, you know, there's thousands of starfish on the shore and there's one guy throwing one starfish in one at a time. Would you just help me to know how much I have to tell this story? Many of us church veterans are familiar with this story. For those of you unfamiliar, it's an old sermon story, allow me. Basically, you're somebody who goes on the beach and there's no one on the beach, but there's thousands of stranded starfish. They've been washed up from the tide and they're going to die. They're all drying up, but there's one guy and he's walking along the beach and he's picking up one starfish at a time and he's throwing it back into the water. He's saving starfish lives. And you walk up to this man and you say to him, this is the story, you say to him, what's the point? What's the point? All of these starfish are dying and you're helping so few. And he picks up one starfish and he looks at it and he throws it into the water. He says, well, it made a difference to that starfish. That's the story. And the way a guy like me, a preacher, would then say, listen, even if you only help one, it makes a difference. It's a good story. I like that story. But it's never sat right with me, that story. I'm not here to spit on a precious story. If the starfish story, some of you old-timers, you're like, that story is precious to me. Don't you touch that story. I'm not here to spit on a story you love. I'm just here to say it's not true. That's all. That didn't quite come out the way I meant it to. Let me say, like, first of all, it's hard for me to not pay attention. Like, if you're saving 1.3% of the population and 98.7% are suffering, I can't live with that. That's my point. Like, it mattered to that starfish. Okay, great. Happy for that starfish. What about the thousands? But here's my larger point. Why is the dude asking a question? Why isn't he rolling up his sleeves and helping throw in starfish? That's the problem with the story. Like, why isn't the starfish thrower saying, would you shut up with your questions, roll up your sleeves and help me, man? Also, have you ever been to a beach where there's only one guy on it? No. I'm sorry, no. If I was there and I'm walking up to the starfish thrower and I'm asking my questions, what's going on? Well, I'm saving starfish one at a time. I would start saving starfish, but I don't go to the beach alone. There's five cusses. Okay, now six of us are throwing in starfish. If we even give 30 minutes of time and you can average, I don't know, eight starfish per minute, that's prorated to 240 starfish per head. There's six of us now throwing in starfish. Actually, there's not six. I forgot. My middle son, Andrew, he would not be throwing in starfish because there's other people on the beach. He would be recruiting 50 people. Andrew, many of you don't know my son, but just trust me. He would be going sunbather to sunbather saying, what are you wasting your life for? Get off the sand. We're having a starfish throwing party. And because Andrew's the way he is, the sunbathers would be saying to themselves, that actually sounds like a really good time. And now we have dozens of people throwing starfish. Even if you gave 30 minutes, you'd have, I did the math for you, 9,600 starfish rescued in 30 minutes. That's the accurate story. That's the way it goes. That's the way the kingdom works. It's called the body of Christ. Every one of us doing our part. I don't mean to say that we make it all go away. I don't mean to put a veneer of optimism over a broken world that is really suffering. I just mean to say that, yes, the problems are still immense, but when we link arms and do it together, the impact is immense. When you give your money or you faithfully serve, you really have no idea what impact it will make 40 years later. Every kingdom endeavor requires money to make it thrive. I didn't used to know this, but every kingdom endeavor that's going to actually help people in need takes money. this is probably as good as opportunity as any for me to pause and say that this is week two in a new series that our lead pastor, Zach Krieger, kicked off last week. I was sitting in the congregation listening to the sermon, blown away by it. If you missed Zach's sermon, I'd highly encourage you to go get it. It was profound. It's still doing a work on my own heart. I'm still considering some of the implication of what Zach challenges to. But one of the things that he said is he was not there to ask us for our money last week. So I just wanted to clarify, I am. Every kingdom endeavor requires money to make it thrive. It's wild. It's wild to me to consider that this is how Jesus operated. Did you know that? Did you know that Jesus had patrons? It's recorded in the Bible. There's not a whole lot said about them, but it's recorded in the Bible that Jesus had these patrons that funded and resourced his ministry. Luke chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. Luke records, after this, Jesus traveled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, the manager of Herod's household. Susanna, and many others. And these women were helping to support them out of their own means. There's not much in the Bible, but this is in the Bible, that this group of women are financially making sure that Jesus and the disciples have what they need to fulfill Jesus' ministry. I'm not particularly interested in the theoretical conversation of men. What would be the impact if these women hadn't funded Jesus? Like, it gets a little weird when you're talking about the Son of God and what would have happened there. But first of all, before we go too far, I don't know if you noticed this, but boy, did this trip me up. When Luke names the women and then he gives one little relationship where Luke just says, look, all of these women have one thing in common. They were cured of evil spirits and diseases. Jesus had healed all of these women. I think that's interesting. We maybe get to that later. But then what? Okay, Mary Magdalene, we know her. But then Joanna, the wife of Chuza, and then Luke mentions it, the manager of Herod's household. It drives me crazy, and this is a common problem in the Bible, where the authors of Scripture say the most outlandish thing and don't bother to explain it. It really bugs me as a Bible student. Like in the Old Testament, when King Saul is trying to discern God's will, so he goes to the witch of Endor. Like the author of Kings doesn't, or Samuel doesn't have a word about that. And then he says to the witch of Endor, would you summon up Samuel's ghost for me so I can talk to Samuel's ghost? And so she does. And Samuel's ghost shows up and Saul has a conversation with Samuel's ghost. And no one is saying that didn't really happen, or we don't recommend that Christians do that. Like, it's just in the Bible. It's crazy. This is one of those, Chuza, the manager of Herod's household. So what I put in the slide is, wait, what? Some of Jesus' ministry funds came out of Herod's employee. When Lisa and I used to pastor in Las Vegas, we had to get used to the reality that a significant amount of church donations came from the gambling industry. Like, our church wouldn't survive if we refused to take money that hadn't come through a casino. I'm not talking about gambling winnings. I'm talking about an entire city that only is driven because of gambling. A lot of people in our church worked in casinos and would tithe their salary. Is that okay? Like, how tainted can money be before it's baptized into God's kingdom? Talk about money laundering. But think about Herod's household manager. What's a household manager in the Bible? It's essentially a combination of a chief financial officer and a chief operating officer. Certainly, Chuza is a C-suite executive. Imagine what Chuza and Joanna saw. Imagine the invoices that came across his desk for approval of payment, the kind of stuff that Herod got into. Imagine the celebrities and the power people that Joanna would interact with. But then Jesus healed her. We don't know what he healed her of. I'm not going to speculate, but it just makes it clear that Jesus healed her. We don't even know if Chuza was a follower of Jesus. We just know that Joanna was. But it's astonishing to me that we are Jesus' plan for ministry providence. You think about it, Jesus could have been born into a rich family. That would have been easy for God to do. Just put Jesus into some kind of trust fund situation in the New Testament. He has everything he needs to accomplish his kingdom. Jesus could have multiplied money like he multiplied loaves and fishes. Easy for Jesus. You know, remember that, talk about things that the Bible never describes. Remember that time where Jesus told Peter to go catch a fish and there was a coin in the mouth of the fish? Like, what? He just could have done that thousands of times and funded his ministry. There are so many ways that God could have resourced Jesus' ministry, but instead he uses Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Susanna. And man, Joanna, she was all in. Not just these wild parties at Herod's palace, not just rubbing shoulders with celebrities and power mongers, but also faithfully following Jesus. She was at the crucifixion when he died. Joanna was there. She was at the empty tomb. Joanna was among the first people to ever witness the resurrection of Jesus. She was one of the evangelists that went and told the other 12, he's risen from the dead. And she funded his ministry. Jesus' followers funded Jesus' own ministry. Just think about that. I mean, this guy didn't even own a donkey. When he needed a donkey, he borrowed it. I've always wondered how this works. You might try this one day. The disciples are like, we need a donkey. No problem, Jesus says. Just go to those people and say, the Lord has need of it. And they do, and they get a donkey. That's freakishly easy. He wanted to host a dinner. The Last Supper is what we call it. We'll be celebrating it here in about 10 minutes. He wanted to host a Passover for his disciples, but he didn't have a room, so he borrowed one. Just like Jesus borrowed every night's sleep and every room where he taught. But Jesus didn't just borrow. He ran his ministry off the funding of some of his followers, his patrons. Three women who were healed by Jesus gave of their money to fund Jesus. The three women who gave to Jesus were all healed by Jesus. Just think about that. We're the plan. And it isn't that we have to do this, it's that we get to do it. I was recently talking to an executive pastor of a large church. And this church in its city, it's thousands of people, it's renowned in its city for its community work. School teachers love this church because they take care of the supplies and the kids in need. Police officers love this church because they serve their local. They're very active, but also globally, the church does incredible global work. They have an amazing youth ministry. They have a renowned recovery ministry. Hundreds of people in recovery come to this church on a Friday night. My point is, this church is very outward focused. And I was chatting to this executive pastor, and he was telling me, he was kind of chagrined about it. He says, oh yeah, we just announced that we're offering a debt relief and a financial health class. One of the ways they serve their people is, hey, if you're heavily in debt, you can come to our class. We'll teach you how to manage your money, financial health. And he got an angry email from a congregant. And among the vehemence in the email, this congregant said, all you guys ever want is my money. That triggered me a little bit. And so the executive pastor looked up this guy's participation record in the church. You know, when you check your children in, there's a record of that. And so he was able to track that for the 12 years that this guy had been attending the church, he had dropped his children off at the children's ministry. He had dropped his teens at the teen ministry. The church had given him some benevolence when he was in need. And then the executive pastor looked up his giving record, and it was $0. 12 years, $0, no donation. You might say, well, he's giving cash. Okay, so he's a tipper. Most likely, he's not giving at all. I don't know if this guy's a follower of Jesus, but he probably is a stingy one. What happened to him? Didn't Jesus heal him? How can he think this is the way? All you want is my money. I asked the executive pastor, we were in a little consult, I said, what are you going to do? The pastor hadn't met with him yet by the time I was chatting with him. I said, what are you going to do? He says, oh, I'm really excited about it. I'm going to reply to the email, and rather than email back, I'm going to invite him in to meet with me, and I'm going to say it's not true that all I want is your money, but I do want some of it. We are the plan. We don't have to give. We get to give. Discovery is an activist church. We've always been that way. It's from the day we were planted. By some of you who are in this room, it was determined that this would be a church for the sake of our city and for the sake of the world. Not the whole world, that's overwhelming. A specific part of the world. And who we help is people here, near, and far. And you can participate in any of that. Here, right in our zip code, in our region, and for sometimes you have to get on a plane to go help. And with the Lao Baptist community, I felt like I got the gift of seeing the end of someone else's generosity 40 years earlier. I'm in a role now, most of my time now, I had this unbelievable privilege of meeting people doing kingdom work in all manner of places and ways. One of the things when I stopped being a full-time pastor and started helping organizations lower anxiety. For those of you who don't know what I do, most of my time now is helping organizations, mostly Christian organizations, some marketplace ones, lower anxiety in the workplace and the home place. I tried to set aside 4 to 6 Zoom sessions a month for anybody that just wants to meet and talk about whatever anxiety is going on in their life. Maybe they've read my book and they wanted to maybe talk about it or something, and I just send them an auto-scheduling calendar, and they pick a time, and we Zoom, and when those slots are filled up, I'm done, and I'm full for 2024. My next availability is 2025, and I did it for a couple of reasons, but the surprising benefit is I get to learn about what God's doing through people I've never met before, and the unbelievable, profound work that they're doing. So I don't have time to tell you about, like, this year. That would take forever. But I can tell you about the last month. That's fun. I Zoomed with a guy named Zach. He's in Asbury, Kentucky. And for those of you who know your recent history, Asbury College had a revival last year. And when I learned that Zach was doing a doctorate at Asbury, I said, oh, were you there during the revival? And he got really embarrassed. And he said, yeah. It was my sermon that accidentally started it. Wait, what? He's like, yeah, I was just on for chapel that day, and I got out, and I preached my chapel sermon, and I walked off stage, he said, and I texted my wife, another dud, I'll be home in 30 minutes. He said, no kind of sermon at all. If you go back and listen to it, nothing about it at all that would make you think it would launch a revival. He's like, I didn't think anything of it. And he said, and the students wouldn't leave. And I texted my wife an hour later, and I'm like, I'm going to be late, because he said, I don't want to leave. If the students are still there, I want to be available. He said, 3 hours later, I texted my wife, I think you better come, bring the kids. Days and days of revival. I got to meet with young Christian leaders in Indonesia. Indonesia is overwhelmingly Muslim. There's a very small pocket of believers, and they all know each other, and they're trying to make a difference. One of them, for example, that is convincing her wealthy dad to donate his barges. He's in shipping, so she can convert them into hospitals, and she floats them to the 12,000 islands around Indonesia so that people on these islands can get care. She started this when she was 24, really made me reflect what I'm doing with my life. She's 31 now, about to expect her second child, trying to figure out, how do I be a mom of two while helping 250,000 Indonesians with her hospital? She's part of a network that is just one of 14 countries. That's just one story from one city out of the 14 countries. Sometimes it's really surprising. I met with a group of financial advisors in North Carolina. It's not a Christian company. It just happens to have Christians in it that want to make a kingdom impact. So they hired a staff pastor. So these financial planners have a pastor on staff. Some of them are quite puzzled by it. I don't know what to do with you. But there he is, and they have a generosity initiative. Whether you're a follower of Christ or not, you can participate in this financial company's generosity initiative. And that doesn't even include the local churches that are just like us, linking arms to make a difference, and of course, the Lao Baptists. It's amazing. This is just 4 weeks. 2 days ago, I Zoomed with the CEO of Oasis International. I'd never heard of these guys. And he wanted to talk, and so we booked a Zoom. And it's kind of wild for me. I get on the Zoom, and I'm even trying to remember, who are you? Have we met? Like, it's really cold. It's a cold call. And he tells me, oh, yeah, we connected on LinkedIn, and I asked if we could connect. You sent me a Zoom. Like, oh, right, yeah, I remember that. Tell me about yourself, I say. Oh, he says, I'm the second leader of Oasis International. What we do is we provide five-day retreats for free for missionaries. If you can get to us, it's for free. I've got a couple of maps for you to take a look at. This is the 14 locations around the world where they have retreat centers. And their goal is to get to 100 locations in the next 10 years. And then in case you are interested in going into missions so you can get a free retreat, here's a picture of one of the retreat locations. It's not bad, is it? I had never heard of these guys. They're helping hundreds of missionaries a year in their marriage, avoid burnout, just catch a breath. No charge. No charge. If you can get to them, it's free. And he was saying, yeah, even the if you can get to us, it's free. He's like, we're not happy with that. He says, right now I've got a bunch of Latin American pastors. They can't get to us. They can't even get to our location in Costa Rica. So now we're raising money for their airfare. I'd never heard of these people. And here is another kingdom initiative that is immense. God's kingdom, look, I know the statistics are overwhelming. I know the issues can feel paralyzing. I'm just here to say God's kingdom is immense. It's often underground. It's often unseen. What God is doing around the world is so far beyond the statistics and issues that we see. I want to go back to Zach's message last week, and as I do, let's have Daniel and the team come up to prepare us for worship. Man, Zach said something last week that really, I'd never thought about it this way before, and I've been thinking so much about it since he said it, where he said, in every other religion, the reason you would tithe or give your money is because the God needed it. Either there was a needy God that needed your money, or there was a God that demanded your money and you gave to appease the God. And Zach said, it's only the Christian God that the reason you give is to reflect God's nature. Because the Christian God is a generous God, and so we give generously because we get to, because we are the imago Dei. We are made in God's image. I've been doing some of my own work lately. I've just been making a list of what are the benefits of being a human being that a zebra or a cat doesn't have. I know this sounds weird, but this is some homework I'm going to invite you to consider. And even now, some of you are hung up on that I said zebra, but that's the way the queen required it. Okay, so it's zebra, just hang with me. But if you think about a zebra and a cat, or really any species that isn't human, they're all over here. Now think of the human being. For those of you who aren't followers of Christ, I think this is all the evidence you need that there's a loving God. The human being has all of these attributes that no other species have. For example, number one, I've started making my own list. When I eat food, I don't eat to survive. I eat for deliciousness. Like I get to enjoy the taste. My dog eats the same food every day. But I get to actually savor. That's because God, I'm made in God's image. But also when I eat, I get to eat to fellowship or relationally connect. I have never seen two cats over a bowl of food saying, how was your day? I've never seen it happen. But humans, the last time we did it was last night. Our house was full of homecoming parents, homecoming in the Cuss family. And we said to the parents, let's come on over. And we just had a big feast. We watched the CU game. We watched that guy drop that catch at 11 seconds, and then we watched that guy catch that catch at 0 seconds. Oh my goodness. And that experience was better because it was around a meal. When I go out in the morning and I walk my dog, I love my dog and my dog loves me, but he does not look at the mountains and feel moved by beauty. I do. I look at the mountains and I feel appropriately small, and it reminds me that my God is big. That's because I'm part of the Imago Dei. I can look at a piece of art and be moved by it. A zebra doesn't. A zebra is incapable of being and saying, that is beautiful. But God put in us the capacity to notice beauty, to be creative. And one of the things that God gave us that no other species has is we get to be generous. It's unique. It's a unique evidence that we're human beings. We get to help one another. We get to take some of what we have and we get to invest it in God's kingdom and make a difference. And so what we're going to do now is invite you, if you're able, to stand and just worship this generous God, and then we'll be participating in the generosity of God through communion. And then for those on the way out, if you want to make a difference, we have boxes and you can give online. Let's sing together.